Good afternoon, everyone. We're a little light today because of the men's camp out, so if you look around, you'll see that the ladies have it today. And when you think about it, really, when you're looking at the spending habits of the United States, well, they're all right here. The preponderance of the women, I think, are at least statistically the ones who make the decisions. Anything, I wanted to make one comment about the men's weekend. It's something that I saw, I don't know, a little while back that said camping is nature's way of promoting the motel business. Now, of course, they're not camping. I don't think any of them are. I think they've all got very nice accommodations. But I know a lot of people have that concept of you know, camping. A number of our children next week will be recognized, and a few will be graduating and moving on in life. And I thought I'd take a little time today to cover a few principles, and this is by way of review, that will help their children, or parents help their children, and prepare them for that time. A time when they will be on their own and better prepared to understand their role in their own families, but in the world as well. One thing that is very important to teach your children is that they should be positive. They need to have a positive attitude. They need to have a positive approach to life. Now, if you were to look for the word positive in the King James Bible, you won't find it because it's not there. But we know when we're talking about someone being positive, some of the synonyms for that are they're trusting or bold or confident. Those are good words to describe someone that has a positive attitude. And I think it goes without saying we all want that for our children. I'm talking about little children, but I'm also talking about adult children as well, because these concepts apply across the board. Not just when they're toddlers, not just when they're teenagers, not just when they're young adults, but some of them can be in their 50s and 60s, depending upon the adult or the parent. They're always going to be your children, just like we are always going to be God's children. There's no age factor other than the fact that, you know, someone has to take a little time to mature from going to first grade until the time they start driving a car. In Psalm 118, verse 8, we're told that it's better to trust in the eternal than to put confidence in man. And in verse 9, it goes on to say, it's better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. And I think that you all know of times when you've been disappointed by an adult, when perhaps an adult has lied to you, or a boss. And I think when they're talking about princes here, you could include the politicians, and that certainly is an arena that everyone knows. There's a lot of mistruth or innuendo or things couched in a certain way to make them appear to be good, to make them appear to be beneficial, and the reality is just the opposite. It's better to trust in God than to put your confidence in man. You can be positive if you have a attitude like that, that that's where your confidence is in God, not in man, not in politicians, not in the rulers of a given country. In 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 5, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 5, Paul's saying, "Now he that hath wrought us for the selfsame thing is God, who also hath given unto us the earnest of the Spirit." He's given us a very, very small portion of his Spirit. When you buy a house, you put an earnest money on it that shows you're in earnest about buying it. But it's not the full price of the house, although some people have done that. But it's usually a very small percentage, like $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever, to show that you're in earnest about making that purchase. And if for some reason you welch on it or you back out, then you forfeit that money. So God has given us a little bit of that Spirit to see how we're going to use it. And verse 6, therefore, we are always confident. And in verse 8, we are confident. When your confidence is in God, you can have a positive attitude. Are you bold and confident with your children? And even when you have problems, do you demonstrate an attitude of, oh, woe is me, why did this happen to me, why was I laid off, what did I do to deserve this? Do you talk like that around your children? We need to be positive. We need to let them see that we say, in this regard, okay, so this is something new. Now, how are we going to watch and see how God delivers us from this particular problem? Do we have that attitude of boldness? Do we have that attitude of confidence? Do we exude that so that our children will begin to pick up on that and will begin, as they get older, to do the same thing? Is there a problem? If this has happened in my life, so what am I going to do? Sit around and moan and groan about it? If I've got that contact with God, if I'm right with God, what about sitting back and watching and having that positive approach to the way we live, that God will work it out? Well, we need to be positive like that in that regard around our children. And here again, I'm talking not only about young children, I'm talking about adult children. I'm talking about those beyond the teenage years, young adults, and maybe in their 30s and 40s, here again, depending upon your age. That process should never stop. It should never go away. You, just because they're wearing diapers and they're no longer wearing diapers, but now they're wearing business suits, does not take away that parent-child relationship. It doesn't go away. It doesn't disappear. So we need to be positive and confident around our children and teach them to associate with people that are positive. And that can be in or out of the church, because that type of attitude will rub off on you and it will influence you. If you're around someone that is so down all the time, continually, and they never seem to be able to extract themselves from that, it after a while will rub off on anyone, no matter how positive they are. So try to associate, and I'm not saying don't help someone who's like that. We certainly should always do that. We should always be there to give them advice and give them an arm around the shoulder or whatever help we can offer. But at some point, you have to realize there's only so much that you can do. Another thing you should teach your children of all ages, is to listen. A very small word, it only appears one time in the King James Bible. Isaiah 49, verse 1. Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, you people from far. The Lord hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name. Listen. Listen to what I've got to say. That's what God is telling all of us. And that's what we should be doing with our children. We should be listening to what they're trying to tell us. Psalm 116, verse 1. I love the Lord because he hath heard. God listens. We love him because he does listen. Because he hath heard my voice and my supplications. He listens to our requests when we pray. Verse 2, because he hath inclined his ear. He's got his ear bent down listening to what we have to say. He's not ignoring us. He's not saying, well, there are 10 billion people, or however many there are, that are requesting this and that. I don't have time for all that. Delegate that to the angels. We can't begin to understand his capacity. We can't begin to understand what he is capable of. It's beyond our mind. I mean, it stretches it and bends it. And at some point, maybe we'll be able to totally fathom it. But as human beings, it's hard for us to understand how he's capable, knowing every hair on our head and knowing our requests. Because he hath inclined his ear unto me, therefore will I call upon him as long as I live. I can have that positive approach. I can have the boldness to call on him because he's listening to me. There's no doubt in my mind. Throughout the scriptures, we have illustrations of that. One thing to do when you are listening to your children is try not to offer criticism or pass judgment during the process. Try not to be critical of what they're telling you. Maybe they have made a big mistake. They want someone to listen to them. They don't want to hear that kind of approach. They don't want to be judged. My father always listened to me when I had something to say, my physical father. My son Greg was kind of on to me because I could have selective listening. I think all men are capable of doing this. But he said one time, he said, you know, Dad, you always scratch your chin and say, sounds interesting. And that was his clue that more than likely I hadn't heard everything that he had to say. But, you know, they know when you're faking it. I think, you know, most children are astute enough to know when a parent is really listening. So listen to what your children have to say. Of course, on the other hand, my oldest daughter speaks so rapidly and has so much to say, it would be hard for me to get a word in edgewise. And I can say that about her because she's not here to defend herself. You know, there's always one like that in every family. Turn to Deuteronomy 1, verse 16. Deuteronomy 1, verse 16. Where God says, I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases, or hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is within. Hear what they have to say. Don't have assumptions about what they're going to say, but listen to what they have to say and really understand, really listen to it. Hear the causes. And then if you do that, it's a lot easier to make judgments. 1 Samuel 26, verse 12. 1 Samuel 26, verse 12. This is where David stole down in the night to where Saul was sleeping and took his spear and his cruse, a bottle of water, from his bolster, which is his pillow or his headrest. So David took the spear and the cruse, and they got away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither awakened, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. So God was helping David with his plan to do what he did. And verse 17, and Saul knew David's voice and said, is this thy voice, my son David? And David said, it is my voice, my lord, O king. And he said, wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after his servant? You know, what have I done, or what kind of evil is in my hand? Verse 19, now therefore I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. Listen to what I have to say. Let me state my case. You know, sometimes our children will do anything to get our attention. They want us to hear what they have to say, and sometimes, in some cases where they feel they're not getting it, especially probably in teenage years more than any other time, is there's one way they will get it, and that's by rebelling against everything they've ever known, leaving, running away, getting on drugs, you know, picking the most obnoxious person they know the parents would abhor. To date, they'll do things like that because they want their parents to listen. What's going on in their life? What's happening? You know, I want you to know that things are not going okay. They want us to simply listen to what they have to say. In Micah 7, verse 7, Micah 7, verse 7, therefore I will look unto the Eternal, and I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Once again, God hears us. The question is, can your children say, my mom and dad hear me? My grandpa and grandma hear me? I hope so. And you know, I'm talking about parents and grandparents here, but this is just as easily applicable to aunts and uncles or anyone that has young people in their lives in some way, because these concepts can be utilized by relatives as well. But they're primarily for the parents and grandparents. Another thing that we need to do as parents and grandparents, don't compare your children or show favoritism. Don't compare them with each other, and don't show favoritism. Genesis 37, verse 2. Genesis 37, verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. So these were his stepbrothers. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now, just exactly what was evil about it, it doesn't necessarily say, only to kind of guess from how they conspired against him later on, is that maybe there were supposed to be 1,000 sheep there, and they had surreptitiously sold 100 to someone traveling by. So they were giving a report saying, hey, Dad, we only have 900 sheep. I don't know, I'm just guessing. But anyway, Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Maybe that was legitimate. You know, he'd waited a long time, he and his wife. And there's something about the baby in every family, I think, that gets special attention. I know in our case, we, in some ways, we didn't pay as much attention, but in other cases or other ways, we paid too much attention. Anyway, Israel loved Joseph and made him a coat of many colors. You know, here's this $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 Brooks Brothers coat that I've ordered specially for you, while your brothers are wearing Goodwill coats or suits that they got for $20. I mean, that's not what happened, but that is what goes through a person's mind when they see favoritism like that, when they see someone being singled out for special treatment. Why him and not me? Verse 4. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more, and you see, this is how that gift, the coat of many colors, manifested itself, because his brothers thought, because he got one and they didn't, that obviously their father loved him more. And what was their response? Their father loved him more than all his brethren. They hated him. That is what happens when you have favoritism. That is what happens when you compare children. Someone ends up getting hurt. Someone ends up being the brunt of that hatred. And it can lead to violence. They hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. Well, there, like I said, is a prime example of showing favoritism, and, you know, basically the rest of the story. Ultimately, somewhere down the line, it ended up in a good way. But for Joseph, it meant being in slavery, it meant being in jail. It meant being unjustly accused. He went through all of these things. And perhaps you're saying, well, maybe God wanted him trained in all these areas. Maybe he did. I don't know. But anyway, that was the end result of that coat of many colors. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. For we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. You know, some that's saying, oh, I'm really great. I do all these things. I have this position. I have this job. And you sit around comparing yourself with them. And they can be relatives. They can be people in and out of the church. They can be people you work with, co-workers. And that's human nature. Some that commend themselves, but they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. There's no wisdom in doing that. There's no payoff for doing that. You may psychologically feel better. Oh, yeah, I'm better than old so-and-so. Look at the suit I'm wearing. Or look at the job I have. And look at what he's doing or what she's doing. God tells us through Paul, don't compare yourselves among yourselves. And you should never do it with your children. You know, how do you compare? Well, it can be with grades. It can be with scholastic achievements. It could be with athletics and sports, or someone, it could be even being a neat person. Someone's room is always neat and tidy, and, you know, his brother or sister is a slob, that type of thing. That may be the case. That's factual. No one can deny that someone's neat and someone's messy. But you never say, well, Johnny has done this, and look at how nice his room is, and look at the slob that you are for what you've done. You never do that with your children. You never compare them. Never. One of the most damaging things to say is, why can't you be more like your older or your younger brother or your younger sister? You know, how good is that going to make that person feel? Oh, yeah, I always hear this, you know, old John or old Jill or old Bill or whatever. I always have to listen to this. You know, I didn't do this myself. I tried never to do it. But my daughter Kelly told me when she was going through high school how difficult it was for her, and it may have been actually in grade school as well. She said, you know, it was really difficult following my sister Patty, because Patty was a high achiever. She got good grades. She was in sports. She was a cheerleader. She did all of these things, and she did them well. She was musical. Now, Kelly was not blessed with the same talents. I mean, she had her own unique set of talents, and I fault the teachers for doing this, because they would always say, well, your sister Patty did so well. Why are you having trouble? You know, what good does something like that do coming from a teacher? You never teach that way. Anyway, she said, I was always following in her footsteps, and I was always being singled out. So when she moved to a different school where her sister wasn't, things changed dramatically for her. Deal with your children on one basis. Don't single them out to compare them with someone else in the family or with anyone else. Treat them or treat their problems as specific to them alone. And don't say something, well, you know, how come your brother is always doing so well and how come you're having problems along this line? Never make comparisons. Treat them as an individual. That's the way God treats us. I would hate for him to be making comparisons with me, using me and someone else in this room. I mean, you know, what can you say? Well, I didn't pray this morning because I was in a hurry. I didn't study and the other person did, or whatever. God doesn't do that. He deals with you individually, by yourself, all alone. It's your life, and that is the thing you need to be concerned about. Don't be making comparisons. Obviously, you know, your children are always going to have problems. We all do. So there's nothing different about that. But because I said to always be positive, I won't tell you about any problems my children are having. I might, by way of illustration, if it's something in the past and they know that I'm going to use their example. But I would never mention that to anyone unless I could use it in that way. I said always be positive, and so, like I say, I won't mention anything about them here. I save that for Veronica. If we've got a problem in the family, she's the one that hears about it. She's got a good ear. Are our children perfect? Far from it. But what about us? Love them for what they are, not what you want them to become, not what you hope they'll become, but what they are in this state they are in right at this point in their life and in your life as well. Guide them, help them to find the right way. Another thing you should do is to encourage your children's interests regardless of what they may be and what direction their interests take them. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 24. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 24. This is a great scripture. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. You know, life is too short not to enjoy what you do every day. If you're punching a clock from 8 to 5, if you're doing some other type of job that requires more hours, if you're working a swing shift or you're working graveyard or whatever it is, think about your life and what God says about it here. And it says, enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. You know, God is sanctioning this concept. Enjoy what you do while you're here. No wonder there are so many problems that people have. No wonder so many people have stress. No wonder so many people are unable to go to sleep at night because they're tossing and they're turning and they're worrying about maybe some aspect of their job or something related to that. Is that the kind of quality of life that you want yourself? And even more, is it the kind of quality of life you want your children to enjoy? Turn to Matthew 25, verse 15. Matthew 25, verse 15. And here, this is the parable of the talents. And Christ is saying, unto one he gave 5 talents, he gave 2 to another, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability. So Christ just didn't randomly parcel out these talents. He gave them to people who had some natural ability. And then he took his journey. You know, your children need advice from you. Whether they take it or not is another thing. But I think one of the worst things that I've learned and observed is when you give advice and then push advice. It's all right to give it, but then don't push it. Just back away. They have to make the ultimate decision. It's going to be ultimately on their shoulders what happens as a result of that advice. You know, the world's replete with dissatisfied people in jobs they hate. What a disaster and what a dismal future if all they have to look forward to is a life doing something they will despise. God's not rejoicing in your life if that's what's happening. He wants you to enjoy the good of your labor. Something else that's important. Do something alone with each child occasionally. Just say you have 4 in your family. Take time to schedule some kind of a time when on a given day, mom and or dad, maybe take the one child out for a special occasion. And this is not something that's a reward or an award of some kind. It's just simply a time to be alone with that child and a time to be able to talk, a time when they're not competing with their brothers or sisters and they're not inhibited, because sometimes the family dynamics are such that some children are unable to do anything. They get in a crowd and they just clam up. Take that child alone by himself or herself and spend time. Show that you really care. Veronica is the oldest of 7 children, and she doesn't talk that much in a crowd. Usually she tends to hold back, but you know, when you get her alone, she talks my leg off. So I know the dynamics of that. You know, what you won't say in a crowd or what you won't do one-on-one, you will feel more freely or more free to respond and or to discuss things. And you know, you try to do this in a very casual and relaxed setting. You don't do it after you've taken them in a room to interrogate them for something they've done wrong. Ephesians 5, verse 16. Ephesians 5, verse 16, where we're told, redeeming the time because the days are evil. It's a well-known scripture. But you think about that in perspective of your life, in conjunction with your children, your grandchildren. You know, life is passing rapidly by. And the older you get, the more rapid it becomes. Are there some things left undone, left unsaid with some of your own children, some of our own children, that we should address, that we shouldn't leave hanging, that should not be left unsaid? the days are evil, the time is passing. Be affectionate and loving. I mean, that's a given. You shouldn't even have to tell a parent that until you hear about the cases of child abuse and you see the pictures of little bodies badly beaten and having died as a result of the bruises or the shaking or whatever was done by a parent who they were capable of starting the process, but beyond that, they should not have ever been involved in trying to be a parent. Be affectionate. Be loving. Learn to be expressive and show your feelings. In Genesis 27, verse 26, this is where Isaac had sent Esau out to get him a lamb or a goat and to make his favorite meal. And his father Isaac said unto him, and this was Jacob masquerading as Esau, "Come near now and kiss me, my son." Very expressive. Verse 27, he came near and kissed him. And he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord hath blessed." So he recognized the odor, and of course here again this is cleverly masqueraded by Joseph, or I mean by Jacob, so he could get his father's blessing. There's another example of this love and affection. Joseph's example when he revealed himself to his brothers. In Genesis 48, verse 15, Genesis 45, verse 15. "Moreover, he kissed all his brethren and wept upon them, and after that his brethren talked with him." So this was how he expressed his love and affection for them. He'd given them a hard time leading up to this, but nonetheless he loved them. He forgave them for selling him into slavery, and this was his way of expressing it. 1 Samuel 20, verse 41. 1 Samuel 20, verse 41. And this is a case where Jonathan told David that he'd let him know if it was all right with him and Saul, his father, by shooting an arrow. And if it fell short, or if it went beyond where it was supposed to, each one of those had significance and was a sign. And in this particular case, as soon as the lad was gone, the one that went and got the arrow, David arose out of a place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times. And they kissed one another and wept one with another until David exceeded. He loved Jonathan so deeply, and the same was true of Jonathan. But he had been warned that Saul was out to kill him, so he had to leave. 1 Kings 19, verse 19. 1 Kings 19, verse 19, and this talks about Elijah calling Elisha. And he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing the 12 yoke of oxen before him, and with the 12, or with the 12th, and Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. Verse 20, he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow thee." So he was a son that did not want to just walk off into the sunset and never, his parents not know what had happened to him. He wanted to go back. And so Elijah said, "Go back again, for what have I done to thee? I didn't intentionally want to put you in a bad position. Go and say goodbye to your parents." In Acts 20, verse 37, They all wept sore and fell on Paul's neck and kissed him. Here again, once again, an example of the love and affection the disciples and also the converts had for the Apostle Paul. I've probably mentioned this before, but I went to a 60th wedding anniversary in Regina, Saskatchewan a number of years ago and met an uncle for the first time, big, tall, two, probably 6'4" or 5", thin as a rail, big full beard, and he saw me and he walked across the room. I walked over to meet him thinking to shake his hand. He grabbed my head like this, and his big bushy beard, and planted a kiss right on my lips. Now, we were Romanians, so to him that was an expression, but it conveyed a really deep, he'd never seen me before. He was my dad's only sister's husband. Great feeling. You know, you've probably heard about the examples, and I think that's probably happened in Romania, the one I remember, where they took and went into orphanages where babies were given the optimum care physically. They had enough to eat. They had their diapers changed and everything else. They had that kind of care, but they had no love. They had no cuddling. They had no human, interaction at all. And what happened was they lost weight. They became sick, and a lot of them then died. You know, this is something that you can see in families where love and affection is missing. 2 Timothy 3, verse 3, Paul writing to Timothy says, telling about the last days, we're going to be without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. That's the society we live in, brethren. You go out on the street and you see how much natural affection you see. Don't you fail to give your children that kind of affection. And I'm talking not again just about little kids. It's easy to do with them. I'm talking about your adult children as well. And finally, set the right example, which is probably the most, or one of the most important one of the most important things. In 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, well-known scripture, be you followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. Paul was demonstrating what a Christian should be, how he should act, what he should do. As a Christian, are you demonstrating what God is like to your children? So their desire to live a Christian life will in large part be because of what you modeled for them. Are you perfect? Are we perfect? Of course not. I know each and every one of my four children would be able to point out some of my flaws without, you know, giving it a second thought. Our children are a grave responsibility. Be positive. Listen. Don't compare them. Encourage their own interests. Do something alone with them occasionally. Be affectionate. Be loving. And set the right example. If you do, you will enjoy a rich, warm family relationship. And as mentioned in the very last verse of the Old Testament, and interestingly enough, CJ had that song, the third song, I think it was, you can be the Elijah who helps turn the hearts of the fathers and mothers in your family to your children, and as a result, they will turn their hearts back to you.